Why should New Hampshire go first today on The World? I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. New Hampshire has the first in the nation primary. But what if another state with a different demographic mix went first?
New Jersey is a state which has a large non-white population. You have a large African-American and a large Latino population, for example.
How that might affect the presidential race. Also, Brazilians scramble to protect themselves from Zika.
Women are consuming bug spray like never before.
Plus, sports gambling is big business internationally, and one company in Curaçao is reaping the benefits.
They were like handling, if I recall correctly, like $12 billion a year.
Those stories, plus a transgender band in India, ahead on The World. Hard to avoid the wall-to-wall talk about New Hampshire today, and we won't avoid it, just hang on. But we want to start off today talking about Zika and the global health threat. This week, President Obama asked for more than $1.8 billion in emergency funds to deal with the spread of the mosquito-borne virus. That kind of money could speed development of a vaccine and help with mosquito control programs here in the U.S. But right now, the main concern is in Brazil, where Zika's already a daily reality. The northeastern city of Recife is at the center of the outbreak and the increase in birth defects that may be associated with Zika. Katie Wirth is a digital reporting fellow at Frontline, and she's been talking to people there as they celebrate Carnival this week. And Katie, Carnival is really a street celebration in many ways, and there's always a lot of women in fabulous but also very skimpy costumes. Are the dresses and the costumes different this year because of Zika?
No, not really. The costumes are as skimpy as ever. People are getting really creative. Some people are getting dressed up as mosquitoes and others as sanitation workers chasing them around. So it doesn't seem to be affecting the number of people who are out on the street.
I know that you've written outside of Carnival, Zika is sort of changing the experience of pregnancy for some women in Brazil. What are they telling you?
Well, wherever you are, there's a whole gamut of experiences of pregnancy. Some people are kind of relaxed about it and go on with their regular lives, and other people are very careful about what they eat and what they do. And some women have left the country if
really?
They have the means to do so. Yeah. There's people who are spending the first several months of their pregnancy, which is believed to be like the most dangerous part of the pregnancy, and they're going to Europe or they're going to Miami or somewhere else if they have the means to do so. Of course, most women in this country don't have the wealth that takes. So women are consuming bug spray like never before, and they're being careful about the water underneath their potted plants. I've seen people who are just covered every inch of their body, which is completely abnormal here in the tropics.
Have there been any indication that the numbers are down in terms of people on the streets for Carnival at all because of Zika? I mean, is there feel like there's anything that's kind of raining on the parade, or does it feel like, hey, you know, it's still a party?
You know, not that I've heard. The official numbers aren't out, I don't think. But that said, there have been some warnings that kissing is a big piece of Carnival. Usually people kiss strangers and friends. And at least one public official here has warned pregnant women against kissing strangers on the street this year.
Because they're not quite sure yet of how it's transmitted or how many ways it might be transmitted. I mean, going along those lines, has Zika changed the behavior of men at all?
The men that I've spoken to don't seem concerned about it. I even spoke to a man whose wife is pregnant, and he said he's not using condoms and that it may be if he gets Zika, he'll start using condoms. So, you know, I'm sure it varies, but I think by and large, from what I can tell, it's kind of being seen as a pregnant woman's problem.
What about on the media? Is Recife filled with kind of warnings about Zika? Are there public health messages as part of the Carnival celebration?
Yes. There are huge billboards everywhere about how to avoid mosquitoes and Zika. And there are health workers handing out cardboard fans that people use in the Carnival to cool themselves off. And the fans have information about Zika on them. So this is something that is on most people's minds, and particularly if they're considering having a child.
Katie Wirth is reporting from Recife, Brazil, as a Tau journalism fellow for Frontline. Thanks, Katie.
You're welcome.
Later this week, we'll be joining Katie in Brazil in a collaboration with our partners at Frontline. It's part of our ongoing Across Women's Lives project. We'll be looking closely at the connection between the Zika virus and climate change. You can follow along and add your thoughts online using the hashtag HerPlanet. And watch a video about our upcoming project in Brazil. That's at facebook.com/AcrossWomen'sLives. Another priority on the Zika front is coming up with a better test to diagnose it. Dr. Mario Stevenson heads the Infectious Diseases Division at the University of Miami's Medical School. He's working on a Zika testing kit right now. Dr. Stevenson, how urgent is the need for this test?
Well, it's as urgent as you can get. Unfortunately, the areas in which Zika is circulating just now are also populated by other viruses that have strong similarity to Zika, including dengue. So the tests that we come up with are going to have to distinguish these very similar pathogens so that one can get a handle on what the incidence is, what the relationship to human diseases might be, and also to track the effectiveness of antivirals and vaccines when they come out.
When do you think you'll have your testing kit up and running for Zika?
Well, we have a functioning test that distinguishes Zika from dengue, and we are exploring its utility with colleagues in Brazil, just strictly for research purposes right now. But if it passes muster with some of the individuals who come into the clinic there in Brazil, then we could have something up and running for research purposes, not for general screening within a couple of months. For general screening, that's going to take a more involved effort so that it gains traction in some of these resource-limited settings that are hardest hit by the infection.
So right now, if I wanted to be tested for Zika, what would I do?
So you would go to a facility that's using our approach, and they would be able to use a molecular test. There are several groups that are using that test. It's not generally available for large-scale screening because it's expensive and involved, but when it comes to the general testing of the population, that will rely on the availability of an antibody test to detect the presence of antibodies in individuals who've been exposed to the virus and infected with the virus.
And is that available right now in places like Recife in Brazil?
There is no antibody test yet for the virus. In terms of timeline, the antibody test is, who knows, could be 6 months, it could be a year out.
I understand you have family in Brazil. How does that figure in your own motivation to develop a test for Zika?
Well, it's part of the motivation. Obviously, it strikes a chord. It strikes a chord also as a father with five children. Any parent seeing the images of microcephalic infants would obviously be moved by those images. Again, I have to caution that there's no absolute causative link between Zika and microcephaly, but we have to take that potential link very seriously. And, you know, for that reason, as parents, we all want to do something to try and stop this emergence of the virus, the potential spread of the cause of microcephaly, because we're all sensitive to issues that affect infants.
Dr. Stevenson, what would you say to Congress as it now debates President Obama's request for Zika emergency funding?
Hit hard and hit early. We need to mobilize funding as quickly as possible, targeted funding. Traditionally, NIH can take a good part of a year to get funding to specific projects if after the project is submitted. So I think we have to fast-track funding for the development of diagnostics and the development of vaccines and therapeutics, and then worry about the causative link between things like microcephaly, Guillain-Barré syndrome, because the research will take longer to figure out whether Zika is definitively the cause of those afflictions. And we should not wait for that to develop the therapeutics, the vaccine, and the diagnostics. So hit hard and hit early is what I would suggest.
Dr. Mario Stevenson heads the Infectious Disease Division at the University of Miami's Medical School. Thanks so much, Dr. Stevenson.
You're welcome.
Okay, now we're going to talk about New Hampshire. Today it had the honor of holding the first in the nation presidential primary, as it does every 4 years. But New Hampshire's not exactly representative of the nation, demographically at least. So what if another more representative state went first? Mark Hugo Lopez is director of Hispanic research at the Pew Research Center. Mark, visiting New Hampshire or Iowa, you might say they're not the most diverse places in the country and possibly not very representative of the nation. But how varied are they demographically?
Well, if we're talking about the Latino population, for example, in the case of Iowa, about 5% of that state's population is Hispanic. And in the case of New Hampshire, it's about 3%. So these states are states that have relatively small Hispanic populations. By the way, nationally, Hispanics make up about 18% of the nation's population. So they're not necessarily where you might expect them to be in the case of Hispanics. And the same thing can be said about African-Americans or Asian-Americans for both of those states. Nonetheless, these states have experienced something that is unique to the Hispanic experience. They've been states that have been destinations for Hispanic migrants, and as a result have seen their Hispanic populations grow, at least since the 1990s, doubling, sometimes even tripling, over the course of several decades.
So how much does this matter? There's been a lot of chatter about it recently, and certainly the demographics are pretty startling. But does it really matter in this political race?
It might matter in determining sort of who is in the lead, at least leaving the states of New Hampshire and Iowa. In the case, for example, of Bernie Sanders, there's been a lot of discussion that perhaps Bernie Sanders may not do as well in more diverse states, states like South Carolina, which is up next, which with a large African-American population, or say when we get to a state like Florida or even Texas, where Hillary Clinton did quite well in Texas in 2008. On the Republican side, we have a large Republican Hispanic electorate in Florida. So when the Florida primary comes up, you might see if Marco Rubio is still in the race, Marco Rubio do relatively well compared to other states. So these states with more diversity can perhaps shuffle the outcomes of primaries on the Democratic or the Republican side. But at the same time, it depends on who the candidates are who make it to those states, and we'll have to see what happens.
Which state currently best reflects the ethnic mix of the nation?
There's two states that I think are really good examples of this. So one state, for example, might be New Jersey. New Jersey is a state which has a large non-white population. You have a large African-American and a large Latino population, for example. It isn't a perfect representation of the nation as a whole, but it's a state that it has urban centers in addition to suburban centers, in addition to rural areas. So in many respects, a place like New Jersey might be one of those states that represents at least the demography of the country more closely than, say, Iowa or New Hampshire. Another state would be Illinois, another state with a large Hispanic and African-American population, both rural and urban population. So in some respects, Illinois, too, may be representative.
What do you think can be done to improve the primary system in terms of having primaries reflect more accurately the actual demographics of the country?
Well, some states have tried to push their primaries to be earlier. If you remember, a few years ago, Florida moved its primary to be actually ahead of the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary, but then Iowa and New Hampshire moved their contests earlier to beat Florida. But this is an interesting question because the nation is diversifying in a number of different ways, both in terms of the share that's foreign-born, in terms of its racial and ethnic diversity, and in the relative size of its youth population. Some states are much more youthful than others, and Iowa, for example, is not the nation's youngest state. So having a switch in or a change in perhaps which states go first might have an impact in drawing out or engaging certain segments of the U.S. electorate. We'll have to see what happens. I think it might be hard to change the current system, as many states seem to be resistant to change. But there certainly has been a desire on the part of some states to try to go earlier, Florida being the most recent example.
Mark Hugo Lopez is the Director of Hispanic Research at the Pew Research Center. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
The challenge of making a film deep in the Amazon rainforest, later on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. A lot of people wager money on elections, but it's not even close to sports gambling online. It's illegal in most of the U.S., but it continues to thrive. New York Times reporter Walt Bogdanich dives into the murky world in a new film for our partners at Frontline. It's called The Fantasy Sports Gamble, and it does cover betting on fantasy sports. But we asked Walt to talk about why gamblers find it so easy to wager money here in the U.S.
They have access to computers, to the internet. The internet is a wonderful thing. It can produce, legitimate riches and illegitimate riches. And in this case, there are these gambling rings that law enforcement just has not been able to shut down, in part because they're located offshore. That's where their computer brains are. But the players are here in the United States.
In the documentary for Frontline, you and a fellow reporter actually find sort of servers and actual installations that are involved in this offshore sports gambling. Doesn't that make it rather simple for law enforcement to go after these people?
Well, that's what we thought. But, you know, where a website is actually operating, it may be registered in, you know, a Caribbean island like Curaçao, just off of the coast of Venezuela. But in fact, it has infrastructure in the United States. And we were able, with the help of other experts, to trace this and find actual servers, say, in New York City or in L.A. or in Chicago. And we were rather, I guess, impressed with ourselves that we were able to do that. And frankly, so were law enforcement officials when they learned what we had found.
You mentioned Curaçao, and that island nation seems to play a big role in online gambling. What's going on there?
Well, they have a very tolerant government, and they are home to a lot of internet gambling operations. They claim they regulate, but they really don't. And when we went to Curaçao, we could not find any public officials there who would be willing to talk to us about, you know, what's going on? What do they do to try and ensure that these servers, these offshore sites are not operating illegally?
How much money moves through Curaçao?
Billions. Billions. There was one site that we looked at. That's one of the more famous ones that actually was featured on one of the episodes of The Sopranos. And, you know, at one point they were like handling, if I recall correctly, like $12 billion a year. Now, it was not necessarily flowing through Curaçao, but that's where the, you know, the internet brains of the operation, you know, resided.
Now, we've seen what gambling has done to international sports. There's match fixing in soccer and in tennis. Has it infiltrated professional sports in the U.S.?
Well, that's the reason that professional sports is so opposed to gambling. Look, there's always rumors about that, but so far, no hard proof of serious match fixing other than a few isolated cases in recent years.
After researching this for so long, what did you come away with in terms of what should be done about sports gambling online?
Well, a lot of the experts that I talked to believe that the best way to handle it is to legalize it. Then it can be regulated. Then it can be taxed properly. Then there can be some measure of transparency. But there are people out there who believe that, you know, going down that path is probably, for society, not the best thing to do, because there is a definite downside to it that society really has to grapple with.
The New York Times' Walt Bogdanich is the reporter on Frontline's The Fantasy Sports Gamble, which premieres tonight on PBS. Thanks so much, Walt.
Thanks for having me.
The Oscar-nominated film Embrace of the Serpent is set in the back of beyond, way, way beyond. It's the first feature shot in the Amazon rainforest in more than 30 years, and it's told from the point of view of an Amazonian shaman, the last survivor of his people, and two Western explorers who form a bond with him. Colombian filmmaker Ciro Guerra decided to make the film after reading the journals of a German ethnologist and an American biologist. They ventured into the region more than a half century ago. Guerra says shooting a film deep in the Amazon was an otherworldly experience. Every day brought something wild and new, like the day he encountered a spider with what looked like a human face.
It had a very clearly human face drawn on its back. I remember I saw a dragonfly, which was about the size of half an arm or something. And it was unlike any other insect that I have ever seen. It was something out of Avatar.
Avatar?
And yeah. You know, every day we would see a new different insect. The shooting would stop because people would just be taking pictures of it.
What was the best thing about filming in the Amazon rainforest?
The best thing was working together with the communities. The indigenous communities. These people are very open, very joyful, and they are willing to share so much. And just to stand there and learn from them this different way of living, this different way of being human. We're talking about people who don't handle money for most of their lives, you know. And everywhere you go, in the deep Amazon, there will always be a plate of food and a smile for you, no matter who you are or where you're coming from. They rewrote the script. They translated the script to the languages, and in that process, the script was rewritten. It was a whole process of 3 years of work that was about the scripts being infused with Amazonian myth, Amazonian storytelling, Amazonian spirituality. So that's how a very Western script became a very Amazonian film.
Did you have to spend time gaining their trust, the indigenous communities you worked with, before you set up shop? I mean, did it take a long time to persuade them that this was a great idea, or were they on board from the start?
They were on board from the start because I was accompanied by Ignacio Prieto, an anthropologist friend of mine who has worked with them for several years in the past.
What was it about the journals of these two explorers, the German ethnologist and the American biologist, who traveled through the Colombian Amazon last century? What was it about those journals and the writing that hooked you on this project?
As I start delving deeper into the diaries, I just discovered that I just thought that it was a fascinating story. I couldn't believe that it hadn't been told. This was a story about knowledge, a story about people from different sides of the river, of the world, looking at each other and, you know, and trying to bring this knowledge together at the same time that it was being destroyed. So it was just, for me, a fascinating story, and I couldn't stop thinking about it, and there was no choice for me. I had to make this film.
In your director's statement for this film, you call the Amazon that unfathomable land which we foolishly reduce to simple concepts: coke, drugs, Indians, rivers, wars. What does that list leave out? I mean, how did this, making this film, change how you think about the Amazon rainforest?
It's difficult for me to describe. I can tell you that there was a moment in which I had a glimpse of a knowledge that was as big as the knowledge that we have built the Western world on. And it was just a glimpse that you're just standing in front of a huge, gigantic wall of knowledge that you cannot possibly fathom. And it's not a knowledge that is written, because they don't believe in the written word. The Amazonian people think that if you write down knowledge, then knowledge dies. Knowledge should always be alive. Knowledge should always be complemented by the paper person expressing it. So the experience of being in the Amazon is being truly in the Amazon, I mean, not just as a tourist, and sharing with the people of the Amazon is an experience that makes you question every aspect of your existence.
Ciro Guerra's movie, Embrace of the Serpent, is up for an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. Find out more about the century-old photo that inspired the movie at PRI.org. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. London is a city transformed by immigration, some of it very recent. Just ask this 20-something Londoner.
There's been such a giant pouring into London of people and of money that in my lifetime, London looks almost unrecognisable to the city that I was born in.
That story ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, who's on assignment in Iran, and you're with The World. We spend a lot of time here trying to convey the scale of the refugee crisis, the millions of people on the move, trying to find a safer place to build a better life. And when you hear about the numbers, it's mind-boggling, and it makes you wonder what any one person can do. Well, here's a story about one man who decided to try something that most of us probably wouldn't do. You could say it's a small thing in relation to the size of the problem, but it's a big thing, too. Here's Adeline Sear with his story from northern France.
Ghaffour Hussain is a committed volunteer. He's traveled from his home in northeast England to several migrant camps in Europe to lend a hand. But now, he doesn't just bring himself. He brings his own bus.
I actually bought the bus off the internet, and we went and picked it up. It was about 400 and something miles away from where we live. And then we took it back to the garage where I work, and we stripped it all out, and my nephew gave me help to kit it all out as a full mobile kitchen.
A full mobile kitchen equipped with two prep tables, a double drainer sink, five commercial gas stoves, and a 260-gallon water tank. Gas containers and storage are in the back and underneath. Hussein bought the large tan bus last December and retrofitted it in his garage in Stockton-on-Tees. That cost him about $9,000, but he got help from his community.
I started off myself personally, then obviously friends and colleagues and everyone started chipping in, and we just had this van delivered from UK, and people have donated food and clothing and everything. And they're also giving donations, as in money, So like this morning we actually went out to the warehouse and bought 2 pallets of water.
The idea came to him after he visited some migrant camps in Croatia, Slovenia and Austria last fall. He says refugees there were fed cold sandwiches. So he decided they needed hot food, and he has delivered that.
I am the cook as well.
On this day, Hussein's mobile kitchen was parked at the Grand Sand camp near Dunkirk in northern France. He's supplying about 3,000 hot meals per day for people living in tents here.
And we do a tea in the morning as well. Then we do about another maybe 5,000 cups of tea in the evening as well. Because as you can feel, the temperature is very cold and everything was frozen. Even you can see the ground is still frozen. And there's no hot beverages anywhere on this camp apart from what we supply.
So what kind of meals do you cook?
We cook rice, lentils, chickpeas, red kidney beans, black-eyed beans, pasta, porridge.
Porridge didn't go over too well in this camp of mostly Kurdish refugees. Since most people here are Muslim, like Hussein, he's cooking vegetarian meals to avoid the need for halal meat. It's expensive and hard to get in this small French town. When he left England with his bus in December, Hussein didn't plan to make a stop in France. He was going to visit camps along the route of migrants traveling up through Central Europe.
I went to Austria with a few colleagues. Once I was finished in Austria, then I got a phone call to say that things are quite bad here in this camp. And then I decided to drive from Austria to here. It took me 2.5 days.
Hussein has been at this campsite now in northern France since mid-January. He's left his son in charge of running the family garage back home. He says he's getting donations from all over Europe, as well as Abu Dhabi and Pakistan, where he was born. But preparing 3,000 meals a day cost about $450, so I wondered whether his funds were going to run out soon.
Well, the way the things are going with the friends and family, I don't think some of my funds will run out. All over UK, people have been funding me.
How long are you planning to be here?
As long as I can keep getting the backing and as long as I can keep going.
So what's your family thinking of all this?
They think I'm a bit mad, but again. No, I've got the full support of my family. I'm hoping to go back for a few days next week and then come back again and keep going.
In fact, Hussein bought another bus, soon to be a rolling kitchen, to meet the demand for food among migrants in Europe. For The World, Adeline Cyr, Grand Sainte, France.
Migration is changing Europe in profound ways, and it's been doing so for quite a while. Perhaps no major city is changing as much as London. Over the past 30 years, it's become an immigrant city like never before. Currently, nearly 40% of Londoners were born abroad, with half arriving since the millennium.
London is no longer the city of Dickens. It's no longer the city of Orwell. It's no longer the city of Cockneys.
Ben Judah was born in London, and he's the author of This is London. In it, he explores how immigration has changed the character of the city.
London's a new city of Qatari oligarchs, of Russian princesses, of African night cleaners and Romanian beggars. There's been such a giant pouring into London of people and of money from Africa, Eastern Europe and Asia, that in my lifetime, London looks almost unrecognisable to the city that I was born in. When my grandparents came to London as Jewish immigrants just before the Second World War, the percentage of Londoners who were immigrants then was 2.6%. And I think the American imagination still sees London as that city, the city of top hats and Cockney geezers and East End gangsters. London now is more of an immigrant city than New York was at its peak.
Now, you spent time with one group of people who make up the new London, undocumented laborers that form a good part of London's workforce. Who are they, and was it easy for you to get entry into that world?
I wanted to write this book a bit differently. I decided I couldn't write a book about the new London just by quoting a few graphs or lecturing people on the effects of immigration. So I went out and I actually lived it. So to understand what the new streets of London are like, I slept rough with Roma beggars. I worked on Polish building sites as a labourer, and I lived in doss houses in East London where Romanian builders sleep in these real conditions of Dickensian squalor, 2 men to a bed.
What is the life like for these people? Is it Dickensian in its own way?
I found a London where the power of the British state has become much fainter. And I found a world of street corners where migrants tout for work, or flop houses, crammed up tenements where people are sleeping two to a bed, seven to a room, where the old regulations of London and Britain impinge only very faintly. Just by scanning the internet in Romanian or in Russian or in Polish, you can find hundreds of flop houses advertising share beds. And rimming London are dozens of construction yards where every morning hundreds of migrant workers are there touting for work. I went and pretended to be a Russian illegal immigrant, and I went and stood in these lines trying to get work every day. And here you find that minimum wage regulation is complete fantasy. Passing by the workers will be dozens of white vans with construction bosses in them, and the workers will have to haggle if they want to get a day's work. And the lowest wage I ever saw was one chicken and chips for a day's work.
Is there any particular person you can tell us about who embodies the New London?
One guy I found who embodied the stories of the New London and the tensions of it was a Nigerian who'd come as an illegal immigrant about 25 years ago. And the dream he'd had was of this glowing city. London in Africa glows. Very quickly, he found himself homeless, on the street, distraught. When he finally started working, he started to believe, like most migrants I spoke to, that London is an ethnic hierarchy, and started asking himself questions of why is it that in all of the kitchens you have African men cleaning the plates and scraping off the cauldrons, whilst all of the people out front are Eastern Europeans serving the food? Is it because the English don't like black people touching their food? Everything he saw began reaffirming this idea that London, for the poor, was a city of a hierarchy. Why is it always Eastern Europeans who do construction, but Muslim men who work in taxis? Why do African women clean buildings at night, whereas Eastern European girls clean the homes of the English by day? Is it because the English don't like Africans touching their stuff? But London still stayed a city of transformation for him, and he began applying to become a policeman and finally got the chance to be a policeman in London. But even though he'd been transformed by London, he, now raising kids in the city, was very frightened of what he saw. And he says that his great fear is that if you're rich or if you're middle class, race doesn't matter. The moment you earn less than $30,000 a year, every job is divided by race, with Africans and Caribbeans at the bottom.
Ben Judah is London-born. His new book is called This is London. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nina Porzucki is in the studio with me. She's one half of The World in Words, our podcast about all things language.
Hey, Carol. So you are the perfect person to talk about this week's podcast, being that you are our one-woman satire desk here in the newsroom. First, just a quick question. How many languages do you speak?
I only speak English well. I speak other languages just, 100
like
words
what?
Each. Like a little bit of Spanish, a little bit of German, a little bit of Italian.
All right, then. Well, my next question was, how many languages can you joke in?
Oof, only English.
Well, I think I can barely joke in one language, which is also English. But this week on the podcast, I spoke with the comedian Eddie Izzard, and he does stand up in not one, not two, but four languages: English, French, German, and Spanish. And he's also learning Russian and Arabic next for some future stand-up shows. But besides speaking all these different languages, Eddie has always joked about language in general.
The Romans, they took over everything. They could do that. They had aqueducts, viaducts. They could move ducks around faster than anyone ever had. And the Romans did all this with a language that we know from school is silly. It's a silly billy language. It has a nominative, a vocative, accusative, a genitive, a dative, an ablative. Off. How did they do so much with a language so silly?
Yeah, how did they? Well, so he's always joked about language, but a few decades ago, he decided that it wasn't actually enough to joke about language. He wanted to joke in other languages. And so in 1997, he performed his entire act in French. And I asked him about that first performance in the podcast.
It had actually been set up wrong. I asked for a very closed room, invited audience, but it was a stage with an open bar shared with anyone else in the area who wanted to come and drink, a big horseshoe-shaped thing. It was so such a wrong place to be. I panicked about that, and then I thought, oh, I can't really lose on this, because even if I just stand up there, that'll be the brave thing.
Funniest, bravest thing ever.
Yeah, it wasn't funny. It was not funny. They asked people afterwards, and all the bilinguals, people were going, and it wasn't. I know. I was there. I was just sweating, struggling. I couldn't get it out, but I did it.
How long before you felt funny in French?
First one I did in 97. In 98, I did a week. So I would guess about three or four gigs into those first six gigs, I would have started to feel, oh, some of this is landing. Then in 2000, I did 2 weeks, and the second week felt okay.
Tous les dinosaures sont stupides. Les grands dinosaures, rah. Les petits dinosaures, rah. Les gros dinosaures, rah. Les minces dinosaures, rah. Pas de poésie pour les dinosaures, oui. Pas de dinosaures qui faisaient...
There was never a point I thought that it wouldn't work where they say, oh, the English human, because there's a thing in Britain we say, which I don't know if you say it in America, say, the French have a visual sense of humor. We just say that. One line, all 60 million of them, they just have a visual sense of humor. Do you have that in America or not?
Well, no, we do have the Germans have no sense of humor.
Yes, now we got that one. That must be a World War II, World War I thing. But the truth is, there are some Republicans in America who absolutely have no sense of humor. Tea Party, no sense of humor. Now. You know, there's a lot of people in Britain, no sense of humor. You know, every country you can find, there are the no sense of humor people, there are the some sense of humor people, and then there are strong sense of humor people. And then there's also surreal sense of humor, political sense, prefer this, prefer that, prefer observational. There are no nationalities that own all the
types of funny
nuances. Yeah. It's like jazz. Jazz is an American-built style of music. But if a brilliant jazz saxophonist was born in China, you'd say that, God, a great jazz player that Chinese kid is. You wouldn't go, oh, you're not allowed to. No, it's an American thing. You Chinese have this sense of music or that sense of music. The sense of music, because rock and roll came out of America, but then, oh, the Beatles, also the Brits could do it. Well, actually, anyone can do it if you want to do it. It's just the sensibility. It's just a style of music.
Hey, what's with the saxophonist thing?
I know. That's the English way of saying saxophonist.
Well, that's kind of funny.
Yeah, two countries separated by a common language.
Yeah.
Well, that's just a little taste, Carol, of Eddie on the World in Words podcast. And he talks to us a lot more about how he's learned all these different languages and also like how he feels that coming out as transgender actually aided him in learning and performing in all these different languages.
Sounds interesting. The world's Nina Porzucchi. Thanks, Nina.
Thanks so much, Carol.
And you can find the World in Words podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. And coming up, a transgender band in India gets happy. It's on the World. I'm Carol Hills with the World. In New Hampshire, it's a day for counting votes. But there's another place where they're counting ballots of a different kind, the Iranian capital, Tehran. That's where our host, Marco Werman, is this week.
Yeah, Carol, there's counting going on here, too. Counting of votes at the 34th annual Fajr Film Festival, which is where I am right now. It's not why I came to Tehran, but it was a good excuse to come to the awe-inspiring Milad Convention Center and Tower, which dominates the Tehran skyline. Great views of the snow-capped Alborz Mountains. Milad is the venue for the film festival. This is, you could say, Iran's Cannes. The finalists will be announced on Thursday. Some of the popular ones include Abbat Vaye Clouz by a 25-year-old director and a feature film, Lanturi, about an acid attack. Lanturi, I gather, is an insult in Farsi for someone who is a novice and a know-it-all, a dangerous combination. I'm here with Amir. He's an Iranian director, and you're not featuring any films this year, but you have in the past. You've seen a lot of the films this year. What do you really like? What do you think should win this year's Fajr Film Festival?
There are some good movies which I liked a lot, but one of them that you've also said that from the young director, 25 years old director, is one of the best, Abad and Yekruz.
And the 25-year-old director's name, what is it?
Saeed Rustai.
And just briefly, what is his film about?
It's about the story of a family who lives in suburbs of Tehran. They are very poor. They have some difficulties. One of the brothers is addicted, but it's about the relations between the brother and sisters and how they live in such a situation. And there are many sub-stories which you can see it yourself.
Amir, thanks so much for explaining what this is all about to us.
You're welcome.
So while they're counting ballots in New Hampshire, here in Tehran, they're counting the finalists at the Fajr Film Festival, with very little attention being directed at that state whose motto, Live Free or Die, might actually be warmly embraced by many Iranians. Wait, did I say very little attention? Actually, there was a lot of consternation in the media here when Republican candidate Ted Cruz said, if elected, he'd reject the nuclear deal with Iran. He's not the only candidate who said something like that, just the latest. And you could say that kind of thing does not do big box office here. For The World, Marco Werman, Tehran.
You can see some of Marco's pictures from his Tehran trip at PRI.org. Finally, even after all the news about Caitlyn Jenner, it's still hard for transgender people in the U.S. to get official government recognition. In India, though, you can check off a third gender box on official forms. But recognition and acceptance are not necessarily the same thing. Now, a third gender band in India is getting a lot of attention. Chavi Suchdev has that story from Mumbai.
Lately, India has been humming to this new version of Pharrell's Happy. And the song's highly produced video, sponsored by Brookborn Tea, has more than 1 million views on YouTube. This is the Six Pack Band, India's first transgender group. But transgender is not really the word here. These women are Hijra, India's third gender, a stigmatized subset of society, and a real presence in cities like the one where I live, Mumbai.
I like the whole video. I like the whole tone and the happiness around it.
That's Pallav Pathankar, the director of programs at Humsafar Trust, a nonprofit that supports the LGBT community. But not everyone in India's transgender community appreciates this commercial presentation of a very complicated situation. Because usually hijras don't seem so happy in public. They're mostly beggars. If you've traveled in Mumbai, you've probably been accosted by a hijra, or Sikhs, begging for your rupees in exchange for a blessing. What differentiates them from the other beggars is that hijras usually look like cross-dressing men in garish saris and makeup. And they have this special flat-palmed clap they do as they get real close, right in your personal space. It's always a bit unnerving to be in their presence because they really do have a presence, a larger-than-life public persona. It's bawdy and pushy and loud.
In India, the hijras are a community almost in exile, standing out to traffic signals after failing to blend in.
The narration before the happy song tries to get Indians to see hijras in a different light, more like the light they see themselves in. Anita Chettiar, a professor of sociology, says that within the hijra community, there are 7 orders or gharanas across India, whose leaders generally reside in Mumbai. Each order has a fairly rigid hierarchy, and they're very secretive. Chettiar says that society, with its binary definitions of gender, is the primary push for men to become hijra. In fact, hijras come from across all socioeconomic classes, religions, and states of India.
So they look out, where can I get this freedom to be myself? How long to wear this mask?
But becoming hijra is not as easy as just donning a sari. Trans women who want to join the hijras are often dissuaded at first by the hijras. If they're adamant, they're allowed to come live with them like novitiates. Then, if they're still keen, they're initiated through a symbolic ritual. Some choose to be castrated, some don't.
Now, there is a belief among the hijras that if you castrate yourself, all your male blood is allowed to flow out of your body.
And the hijra goddess Bahuchara Mata comes and blesses her. She endows her with all female qualities. These days, hijras have 3 professions. Mangti, which is begging on the streets and trains. Ritual begging, which happens in a more welcoming manner on occasions like weddings and births and birthdays. And the third profession is sex work called dhanda, or just the trade. A trade that leaves them wide open to assault and abuse. A few are now stepping out into salaried jobs. And it's a slow movement, but it's happening. Professor Chettiar knows hijras who work in NGOs and even offices. But for most hijras, it's a rough time. Even in my lifetime, I've seen fewer hijras at festive occasions, coming to bless a baby or newlyweds. I've seen people treat them worse than animals, yell at them, kick them. And the second single by the Six Pack Band goes into that. Sab Rab Ke Bande, meaning all God's folks, is more poignant and shows all the stigma and prejudices that hijras face. The band isn't thrilling everyone. One trans woman I spoke with said, "My biggest criticism is that the hijra women who are supposedly the band seem to have zero creative control over the song. They are just props." But the thousands who've liked and commented on Six Pack Band's videos don't seem to care. Finally, there's someone who's come up with the beautiful and bold idea to show support towards equality and also to the LGBT community, writes one commenter. Another says, "Great effort for humanity." That's a lot to put on one band with only two songs. But I do think we're Sab Rab Ke Bande, and I, for one, am quite happy to have a hijra's blessings when I'm commuting. For The World, I'm Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai.
And I'm Carol Hills at The World here in Boston. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.